What's up, guys? So today we have a podcast with Nicholas Verhoeven of the Physionic Channel. We're going to break this one into two parts because we went pretty long and we dove into a lot of really interesting topics ranging from cholesterol, LDL specifically, and a recent publication on Oreos actually bringing down LDL more than statins. We talk about curcumin, creatine, collagen, a lot of different supplements here, a lot on longevity that I think you guys will find very interesting. We are going to donate to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital for this podcast. So below, we will have a link to that charity as well as to Nick's channel, of course, and his Instagram. Again, thought it was a great podcast, really enjoyable. We'll have part one this week, part two next week, and hope you guys enjoy.
All right, everybody. So today on the podcast, we have Nicholas Verhoeven. How are we doing, man?
I'm doing excellent. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. Like I was saying before we started recording, very excited to talk to you. My space in YouTube has been basically like the quote unquote fitness industry. And you can kind of narrow that down even more to like the evidence-based fitness industry, which is great. But I really like talking to people who are maybe a little bit tangential to that, where you have this interest in health. I know you've mentioned on your own channel, you have an interest in gaining muscle and being fit and all that as well. But going on your channel, you really dive deep into the science of some of these like nutritional factors that might affect longevity and whatnot as well. So obviously we'll have, you know, links for people to check out your channel if they haven't come across you. But yeah, very much looking forward to talking to you today.
Yeah, likewise. Honestly, anytime I have the opportunity to discuss science, I'm 100% game. So yeah, thanks.
So we were just finding out that we have a little bit of a similar background, at least as far as location goes. So can you tell people kind of who you are and what you're doing?
Sure. So I'm trying to reconcile our conversation with what I should tell the audience. I guess what's pertinent. So I guess a brief background. I got my bachelor's in arts in psychology, actually, at ECU, which is what we were discussing, or East Carolina University, for those unaware, go Pirates. And then I got my master's in exercise physiology from the same institution. And then from there, I moved on to my PhD at the University of Maryland Medical School. So that's currently what I'm doing. Finishing up my PhD in molecular medicine, and I've been throughout this journey since before my master's program. So the shift from psychology to physiology was actually right when I started this this brand of Physionic, where I wanted to essentially bridge the gap between the public understanding of science. And I don't mean that from like pop science, like real, the actual nitty gritty of science and understanding how to read a study, essentially, like looking at medical studies that can be incredibly daunting. And I wanted to learn all the techniques and all the statistics and all that, and how to actually read the studies, and then bring that in an open format for the public, people that maybe don't have a biology degree, to actually understand those nitty gritty details. So instead of me necessarily being like dumbing down the information, like you see in a lot of pop science channels, which there's nothing wrong with that, of course, it's just not my style. I wanted to selfishly be able to read the studies that I was really interested in, but at the same time also make that publicly available for people so that they could also benefit from it. So that's where I started Physionic, and that's what I've been growing over the last many years.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. So yeah, so we were saying before, so your undergrad was ECU, that's where my residency was. You're at the University of Maryland now, that's where I went to dental school. It seems like we actually lived just a couple blocks away from each other. And actually, mm-hmm. My undergrad, I also studied psychology and then went on to get an exercise science degree. So that was my bachelor's. So wow. Yeah, some shocking similarities there.
Yeah.
Cool, man. So let's see. So there was quite a few things I wanted to dive into today. I have, you know, I think maybe a good one to start with, since I just saw your podcast about it yesterday, was this Oreo experiment that was done. You know, at some point I'd love to talk to the other Nick about it too, but it, basically, for people who don't know, there's, I don't even know if I would call it a controversy, but for many years, there has been discussion on what causes heart disease, right? If we like break it down just like to the base level. And it seems like LDL is this causative factor. And I know even going back years, like Peter Attia had not really debated, but had somewhat debated like David Feldman about this. And, you know, basically how causal is it? And then, you know, we get into the topic of these lean mass hyperresponders and whatnot. So I've only seen actually, as far as your views on it, I've maybe seen one or two videos, but my understanding is you would agree with the stance that LDL is causal in heart disease. And do you believe somebody like Peter Attia's statements where he would say, hey, if you could get your LDL, which I know there's a lot of hate on it being the bad cholesterol, but for people who are coming into this with basically no background, that is typically the lipoprotein that people would say is a negative marker for health, right? You want lower LDL. Somebody like Peter Attia would say, hey, you want this below 70, you want it as low as possible, to the point that he almost believes that you would eradicate heart disease if you could bring LDL very low. Where do you stand on that before we dive into this experiment?
Yeah, so I definitely agree with Dr. Atiyah on most things related to this topic. I would not characterize it as, I wouldn't say that if you drop your LDL to essentially nothing, that you would eradicate heart disease. The reason why I say that is because heart disease is so multifactorial. So there's more to it than just LDL, but LDL is one massive factor that plays into it. The reason for that is because heart disease is an overarching term. When heart disease discusses things like atherosclerosis as well as arteriosclerosis, and we focus the majority of the content that you see out on the internet or just studies in general focus a lot on atherosclerosis. So to describe that for anybody who's not familiar, atherosclerosis is the buildup of plaque that's found inside your arteries. So if you have this plaque that starts to build up, then you decrease the opening within your blood vessels, which then obviously disallows blood flow downstream, which can have disastrous consequences. You can have heart attacks, you can have stroke, you can have all kinds of other issues. Now, there are other types of heart disease or heart disease related conditions. Like you could have a hemorrhagic stroke, which is the actual release of like the blood actually leaving the blood vessel, which may or may not have anything to do with atherosclerosis. You can also have arteriosclerosis, so you can have the stiffening of the arteries. So I don't know, like I'll just say that I don't know the role that LDL has in those areas of heart disease, but when we talk about the most common type or the most commonly discussed type of heart disease, which is this progressive plaque buildup, then I completely agree with Dr. Atiyah that LDL is a causative factor for this that type of heart disease progression, which is extremely common for a lot of people. That said, one of the issues that people bring up is that LDL is not necessarily the best indicator of heart disease or atherosclerosis. I'll limit it to that, to atherosclerosis type of heart disease. And that's because you alluded to it, that there are they're lipoproteins, so they carry cholesterol throughout our system, but they have these proteins that are attached to them called ApoB. And there are many other types of, I shouldn't say many, but several other lipoproteins that also have that ApoB carrier. And now the research has become a little bit more clear that we should be measuring not LDL-C, which is the actual measure of the cholesterol molecules within these particles, but actually measuring the proteins themselves. Because you only have one of these proteins on every single one of these particles,
Right.
and you can have differences in the amount of cholesterol found in each particle. So it's much more accurate to look at ApoB.
Right. And it seems like I personally have not heard as much in recent years about LDL particle size, right? Because we measure LDL-C, right? The actual cholesterol content, I guess. But then there was LDL-P. And then, a lot of people would say, well, it's these small, dense LDL particles that are really problematic, and these larger, fluffy LDLs are not as problematic. I don't hear people talk about that as much as I did, maybe even just like 4 or 5 years ago. Have you seen anything new on that topic?
So I've been pretty plugged into this just because there's kind of a groundswell of some people that are very vocal against the idea that LDL is a causative factor. And sometimes there's these nuances. So there's kind of this gradation of some people will say, oh, it's definitely, it has nothing to do with heart disease. And then there's the majority of scientists and doctors say that, yes, it's definitely causative. And then in the middle, there's some people that say, okay, yeah, it's causative, but it has to be, to your point, the small, dense LDL as opposed to the large, buoyant, or fluffy LDL. And, there's been research that's looked at that in depth. You can there's different versions, different types of research that have been done to look at that. Like one example, there's this study called the MESA studies, the MESA study, and they separated out the effect that small dense LDL have on atherosclerosis risk, or you can actually see the plaque buildup within the arteries over years. And then they looked at people that had more of the large, fluffy, or buoyant LDL, and they found that atherosclerosis risk was still present for both types. So it didn't matter. The mechanism by which they caused that plaque formation may be slightly different in that most people would blame the small dense LDL because it tends to oxidize more, meaning that it gets damaged and therefore that leads to this plaque buildup. But then the idea is that people will then say, well, that's why this large, buoyant, fluffy type is not dangerous. And that's not true because they also oxidize. They just oxidize a little bit less than the small dense, but just because it's a little bit less doesn't mean that it's not a risk factor.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what I've come across when I've looked into it as well. I just wanted to make sure that I was up to date there. But yeah, cool, man. So basically, I think Lane Norton covered this in a video. A few people have covered this in a video. This experiment that, and obviously, people can just refer to your podcast that you just had released on this to get the in-depth information. But what was interesting was it seems like he's in med school now, PhD as well, Nick Norwitz, who had done this experiment where he was doing a ketogenic diet for inflammatory bowel disease. His LDL skyrocketed, and then he ate Oreos essentially for 2 weeks, and it dramatically brought down his LDL more than twice as much as the statins did when he basically did a washout period, took statins, which I think it was 70% lowering versus maybe mid-30, something like that. According to them, they expected this, right? This kind of fits into their model. I know that Peter Attia strongly believes that even if somebody is a lean mass hyperresponder, maybe I should back up and kind of define that. So again, for people who are coming into this relatively new, there seem to be a category of people, and I fall into this. So I have done multiple ketogenic experiments as well as one carnivore experiment where my LDL got into the 200s on keto, but into like the mid 300s on carnivore. This was while still having high HDL, low triglycerides, low CRP, inflammatory markers were all good, all of that. And it seems like that is, I don't know the number, the percentage. It's actually a lower percentage than I expected. Do you know offhand how many they said people were lean mass hyperresponders when doing such a diet?
I remember having, so I'm going to have a part two to the segment that you're talking about, the
Okay.
podcast that you're talking about. And Dave Feldman talks about it, but I think it's like one in, don't quote me on this, but it's like one in like 1,000 or something like that. It might
Really?
even be less than that, actually.
Oh, okay. I was thinking it was like closer to 10%. Because it seems like there's, I mean, again, when you're talking online, obviously the potential population of people is very large, but I certainly seem to fall into that category myself. So, and there's basically discussion, and I would have to think that when you look at the, you want to call it the metabolic profile, when you look at the overall blood work of somebody who has high LDL with low HDL, triglycerides off the charts, inflammatory markers are high. Obviously, that is a very different person and a very different, I would say, when you're looking at like overall risk factors, it's obviously a much higher risk individual than somebody who only exclusively has LDL. But does that mean that the LDL component itself is any less risky? I mean, obviously, I don't know the answer to that. I think Peter would argue it is just as risky. So, I mean, did you get a sense after talking with them that they're more in the category of we just don't know yet? Or do they really feel like, no, this is not going to be a problem for those individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little bit tricky. So Obviously, I lean again towards Dr. Atiyah's perspective. However, I think that we need to be pretty open-minded to this situation. Actually, we need to be completely open-minded to the situation. So I don't necessarily agree with, I haven't heard Dr. Atiyah talk about this to any great degree, so you're more educated than I am on that topic. But if he in any way says that we should, dismiss this and say, oh, well, they're definitely at risk and whatnot, I think that would be short-sighted, because I think that we need to, okay, so I'm gonna kind of break this down in terms of like how I understand it. If in the big picture of things, we take these massive data sets, we take, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that we put together, plot together from all these studies, looking at LDL, looking at ApoB, and we end up creating these patterns. And it's not just when people think of like correlations, right? They think of correlation is not causation, which is absolutely true and whatnot. But correlation studies give us strong indications of what to kind of chase, what to look at in more depth, and try to create causation. And these correlation studies, there have been stronger and stronger statistical models that we can start to use to start to separate out different groups of people. So, for example, like you pointed out, high triglycerides, low HDL, maybe have high blood sugar, like, these kinds of different metrics that are kind of ancillary to the whole LDL situation, but they also have high LDL. Well, these statistical models can now start to separate out groups of people that have low blood sugar, high HDL, have low triglycerides, but have high LDL, and they still show that there's risk associated with having this LDL. So that's one, just one. There's multiple lines of evidence that indicate that LDL is this risk factor. So that's kind of the general idea of how we got to LDL being a risk factor, along with many, many other studies that I won't go into. But the thing with lean mass hyperresponders is that is such a subset of individuals that they could get lost in this sea of overall data. So I think that it would be, I think my perspective is that it's unfair to immediately characterize these people as being at risk if we don't have any specific data to these individuals, because they have this such a stark phenotype. They have such a dramatic difference in their blood profiles, this high LDL, high HDL, very low triglycerides, and tend to be leaner individuals. So it's possible that in this sea of data that we're missing this subset of individuals, that we need to carve out this additional study population and see if truly they are also at risk, just like everybody else.
Right.
So from Dr. Atiyah's standpoint, I completely understand, and I fall into that mentality of, for now, we need to base things off of what the current evidence says. But if Dave Feldman and Nick Norowitz were able to show that LDL is not a risk factor for these individuals, then I would be absolutely on board and say, oh, yes, then there's an exception to the rule. But one of the problems that I have with the experience, with the study that they're doing, is that there are a few weaknesses to the study that I feel like, even when the study publishes, because of these inherent weaknesses, I would need to have more proof to indicate truly that these individuals are risk-free from this LDL issue, which I think Dave might disagree with me on that front.
So I actually only just briefly saw a clip, but basically Dave Feldman was on Atiyah's podcast years ago, and I believe there was quite a bit of debate there. And basically Atiyah saying that he was only a little open to the model, and after talking with Dave Feldman, he was even less open to the model. But I'd have to go and listen to like the whole podcast. I actually Your podcast with them is still on my playlist. I've only gotten a little bit in so far. Could you just briefly tell me what what that experiment that they're running is that you would then later need to see a little bit more?
So the podcast where I broke it up into two parts, but on my podcast platform, I'm going to be combining them both. So the first part that I already have public that you're currently listening to is the Oreo experiment. That is a single person case study, and that does not tell us anything about risk. It just tells us about this interesting phenomenon that you described at the 70% drop in LDL, but it doesn't speak anything to the actual risk. So that was one aspect. And the other aspect we talked about was science, responsible science communication, which, I mean, we're having that right now. And then from there, I dive into the actual mechanisms with Dave Feldman. So we go into serious depth into like what could be the possible mechanisms for how LDL gets into the plaque and all this stuff. But then we briefly touch on his study that he's currently working on. And I think it's going to publish in the next few months, something like that, where it's this prospective study. So it's an associative study, which again, I have no problems with that. But the way it's designed is that they found people that fit into this lean mass hyperresponder phenotype, this kind of overall, again, high HDL, high LDL, low triglycerides. And then they measured them at one point after they'd been on a ketogenic diet for, I think, 4 years up to that point. So this phenotype of this high LDL, high HDL, and low triglycerides is caused by a ketogenic diet, specifically a low carb diet. And so these people had retrospectively, as in these people told the researchers, we have been on a ketogenic diet for 4 years and they have this phenotype. Okay, so they fit the criteria of the study. So at that point, from that point on, the researchers did a bunch of scans to their arteries to figure out if they had calcified plaque and if they had soft plaque. And that's really important that they do both because soft plaque is probably going to be more telling than the calcified plaque. But anyway, so they end up doing both. And then 1 year later, as they stay on this ketogenic diet with this very high LDL, then the researchers do another scan for the same metrics, soft plaque and calcified plaque. And then they just measure, okay, are there going to be any differences between, 0.1 to 0.2? So 1 year later. And we're still waiting for the results, but my guess is they're probably not going to see any changes. And this is where Dave and I disagree. And I generally think that his points are actually pretty well taken. I think that he makes some really great points. It's just that I just don't buy them. That's really what it comes down to. So it's just intellectual disagreement. That's it. It's not like I think that he's just making things up out of thin air or anything like that. He's super intelligent, and I love speaking with him, and getting into the mechanisms was a lot of fun. But anyway, so I have a few gripes with the study design, which unfortunately I didn't get to get into any great detail discussing with him because we got so excited talking about the mechanisms for 2 hours, but it was still
Well,
interesting.
it just sounds to me like it's going to be a very difficult thing to ever have strong data on or strong enough data on, in the sense that, I mean, he's already saying, hey, the percentage of people that are, well, first of all, the percentage of people who are even going to stick to a ketogenic diet, if we're talking compared to the whole population, is very low. Obviously, again, when you're looking at the entire internet, there's many, many people who do it. Most people I know who have done a ketogenic diet do it for short periods of time. They try it, not to say it's a fad diet, but that it is something that people get hyped up about and then they stop. Or they're really not even in ketosis, right? They think they're doing a quote unquote ketogenic diet, and really they're just doing more of a low carb diet. They're not necessarily in ketosis, which I'm not actually sure if being in ketosis is a requirement for this within the study or not. But in any case.
I don't know. I don't know. I know that glycogen levels have to be depleted, so you have to be low enough carbohydrate that you're not replenishing glycogen, which is the stored form of glucose for those listening. So I guess maybe like, is it under 50 grams of carbohydrates or 40 grams, which would be, you're getting pretty close to that ketogenic state. So I don't, but I don't know. Anyway, go on.
I mean, even for me, when I've done a quote unquote ketogenic diet, I've done it numerous times. And I can tell you that when I started actually measuring ketone levels, I mean, I was barely in ketosis. I'm talking like 0.5 millimoles at time. Now, I was doing this along with a high protein diet, which obviously can confound things a little bit, and it is harder to be in ketosis when you're on a high protein diet. But in any case, so already you have a hard time finding those people, and then within that population, you have to find people who are these lean mass hyper responders. And then you have to get them to do it for a long enough time. I mean, one of the biggest issues with some of these studies to determine, for example, and Atiyah talks about this, you try a new drug and you say, okay, well, did it lower, risk of heart disease or MACE or whatnot? And then maybe you detect that, but then there's no change in overall mortality for reasons that you obviously know and whatnot. So I would just assume that the length of time that you would have to follow somebody who is okay, I'm okay with doing a ketogenic diet, I'm a lean mass hyperresponder, and to actually determine statistical differences in risk, I mean, you would know better with the study design than I would, but I would think you would need many years. Like you would probably need to look at like over a 10-year period, was there an increased risk of cardiovascular events? I mean, wouldn't this be a very difficult thing to actually get people to comply with long term?
You bring up a lot of excellent points. There's so those are some of the negatives, I think, of that prospective study. One, it's 1 year in duration. So to your point, you're not measuring over longer periods of time, which a lot of the studies that look at cardiovascular disease tend to focus on longer than 1 year. That said, there are studies that look at 1 year, and they do look at the same metrics. They look at soft plaque formation, so they're not necessarily looking for hard outcomes. They're not looking for like specifically myocardial infarction, heart attacks, or stroke or anything like that. But you do, of course, have those studies as well. So one thing is the time horizon. The second thing is exactly to your point, it's really difficult to have people to find people that fit this phenotype. And on top of that, they're willing to stay on a ketogenic diet for, 5 years or 10 years or whatever it might be. And so the sample size that they have, I think, is around 100. I could be a little bit off on that, but it's around 100. And when we look at LDL studies, they're usually literally thousands, tens of thousands of people that are included in these studies. So I think and then the other major critique that I have of this study is that they don't have a control group. So in science, it's incredibly important to have what's known as a positive control, which indicates that the sensitivity of your measure is actually sh that the measure that you're using actually shows a difference. So if there were a difference, can you detect the difference? Because if you don't have true knowledge that your test is actually sensitive enough to detect the difference that you're trying to detect, then you don't know if the reason why you didn't see something is because the research technique didn't work, or if it's some other reason. And so that control group is critical to a good quality study. And I think that Dave acknowledges that. I think his pushback to our critique, or what we've just been talking about, the time horizon and the low sample size, is that these people have such high LDL that you would expect to see a difference because I forgot the terminology he uses. I think it's the LDL over time, LDL years exposure, something like that. I might be slightly off on that, but essentially the concept is that these people have such high LDL that they have double, triple the LDL that you would normally find, that it condenses the time horizon significantly because you would start to see this atherosclerosis risk occur much earlier on, which I think is actually a really good point. But again, we can't have that assumption without the proof that that is actually the case. We, no matter what, you have to have a control group to actually be able to detect. Because if after a year you see no differences in plaque formation, if you have a control group and they also don't see any changes in plaque formation, that literally tells you that the study is not long enough. So, and they just don't have that comparison. So, they did do something else with a comparator group using another study population, but I'll leave that for if you want to get into it. But the point is that it's just there's some disagreements on this particular study. But regardless, like the big picture is, I'm really excited for the research, and I love talking with Dave, and I love talking with Dr. Norowitz as well. And if we can continue to do this kind of research in that this area, and maybe find an exception to this LDL thing, I think that'd be so cool to be able to discover that effect.
Yeah, I mean, I really find the topic fascinating. I myself am kind of in this gray area of LDL where I've always been around, 100 to 130, where it's like, it's not, I mean, obviously, other than the times where I've been in a ketogenic diet, and it's like, hey, everything else is great. My LDL, I mean, my HDL has always been high, triglycerides low, like all blood work looks great except for that one thing. And again, I hear somebody like Atiyah, who overall I agree with on most topics. And I mean, man, he makes some very strong points for really lowering LDL. But then, you do get the people who have the concerns over statins, and you have some really intelligent people who have concerns about bringing things too low. Then you have the people who are more, like I've had Sean Baker on the podcast, and he's a big the carnivore guy. And you get some, I mean, some of these people you really start delving into the category of like grifters, and some people who are genuinely disingenuous, I believe, but other people who are just not informed. They did a diet for a couple months, it was great, so this is now like the Holy Grail, and all of that. Of course we see, but you can't deny that there are many, many people who really experience great benefits by switching to such a diet. And again, of course, hugely confounded by the fact that if somebody does, let's say, a carnivore diet, they tend to lose weight. So that is a huge confounder, right? You're eating less overall, even if you think you're eating more, you're losing weight. A lot of times when you have these dietary changes, you become more active. There's a lot of confounding variables. But even within that, you absolutely have people like, popularly a Michaela Peterson, but also somebody very intelligent like a Nick Norwitz, who is like, hey, I have an autoimmune condition. I have inflammatory bowel disease. I have rheumatoid arthritis. And I am very clearly better on this. Even, some actually testing their inflammatory markers or getting colonoscopies and whatnot. And it's like, man, like I'd hate to, because you do see some people who are very blunt online who will kind of call these people like carnitards and whatnot. And really, and I understand the frustration with some of the people in this population, but I think the topic is fascinating because some people's lives are dramatically improved by it. And it would be wonderful if it turned out, hey, you know what? You're not having to exchange your health, your atherosclerotic risk for these other benefits. Maybe it's actually not problematic. I mean, that would be great news for them.
Yeah, there's a lot there. So you brought up a lot of excellent points. Yeah, so the way that I frame things, one thing is it's really difficult because people think about things so black and white. They're like, well, this diet has to be great at everything, and this diet is bad at everything. And really, there's so much nuance, and so much is dependent on the individual, of course. I mean, everybody knows that at a certain point. So jumping on exactly to your point, if you were to jump on a carnivore diet and your LDL shot up at every other symptom that you had, you suddenly got rid of your depression, you suddenly got rid of your arthritis, you got rid of back pains, you got rid of all these other factors. I mean, I would have difficulty looking at that person in the eye and say, well, you should get off the carnivore diet because your LDL is high. Like that's I mean, we get so lost in that this is one factor of life. LDL is one risk factor. There are many others. Blood pressure is another one. Lp(a) is another one. You've got smoking risk. You've got physical activity. You've got weight. You got all these other factors. So to get so focused on LDL and say, well, you need to change your diet, it sounds kind of preachy, and I think that it also fails to take the person's other aspects of health into consideration. So if their risk factor is a little bit elevated in this one way, but they're able to mitigate as much of it in many other ways, I think that's totally okay. In my opinion, if somebody were to come up to me and ask me, not that I'm an MD, but I'm getting my PhD in this stuff, I would say, like, do it, like go for it. Do what makes your life not a living hell. I think that's the way that I would approach it.
Yeah, totally. So switching gears a little bit, you had a
Sure.
video recently on, it was, basically five habits that would help people on longevity and whatnot. And within that, there was diet. And I have a question for you regarding the dietary aspect. I'd have to go back and look at the actual video for all five, but one of the factors within was low sodium. And this is something basically, and I mean, we see research that shows that lower average sodium intake correlates with, like better health. This is something I've never been able to get a clear answer on, and that is whether or not this is simply correlational, and if high sodium intake is problematic if blood pressure is controlled. My understanding is, one of the concerns people have is, hey, if somebody has hypertension, keep your sodium low, and there's the fluid dynamics that get involved with that. But I've never personally come across anything that indicates, again, other than maybe a correlation, if you have high sodium, but your blood pressure is perfectly fine, is that problematic? Do you know the answer to that?
I do not know the answer to that. I have not done any deep dive on sodium specifically. So I can speculate, and I would speculate that you're right, that if you don't have any problems with blood pressure, able to maintain your blood pressure, then sodium is probably far less of an issue. I'm trying to think of any particular mechanism that sodium would affect our body negatively. I mean, as I'm sure you know, blood pressure is not just going to affect your heart disease risk, but it's also going to affect your kidneys, which is really the one of the main areas that blood pressure can be so detrimental, and of course affect your brain as well. And that's usually what people focus on, but I haven't done, like I said, I haven't done a deep dive into sodium. So I think for me to like espouse and wax philosophical about, oh, it's, yes, sodium is still an issue. The true answer is I have no idea. I need to look into it, and then I can come back and give you a more exact answer.
Yeah, no, I was just curious because it's something that I'd seen a couple times, and anytime I hear somebody, because of course you hear something contradictory to what you're doing, and you always kind of wonder, like, well, should I be changing that? Or you even want to defend your habits, of course. And
Yeah, of course.
my blood pressure has always been, if anything, low. But it's always, 110 over 70, if not lower. So to me, and I love salt, so I'm just like, is there any reason to drop it? And I haven't seen anything that, mechanistically that would indicate that it's a problem. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, right.
So one experiment that I'm doing now, and I know this is obviously our first time talking, but I'm big on experimenting with, one's own diet and training and whatnot. One thing I've gotten a little bit known for in the industry is with training, and I bring up my calves are very stubborn body part, and I went 3 years training only one calf, and after that 3 years, there was no difference in size whatsoever. So that's something I've kind of become known for, and other people who I've talked to on the podcast have then done their own experiments. One of my friends, Brian Borstein. And keep in mind, we're all like 15 to 20 years into lifting. So obviously, after that much time, you're not going to see much of a change in a lot of things anyway. But I also have done many dietary experiments. I've mentioned ketogenic, carnivore, a number of other ones. One thing, because of the topic that we just discussed on LDL, that I am trying is dramatically lowering my saturated fat. Now, my understanding is that outside of the extremes of dietary cholesterol intake, for the most part, dietary cholesterol is not going to affect blood levels of cholesterol for the most part. However, it seems generally agreed upon that saturated fat intake does correlate with higher levels of LDL. Although Nick Norwitz brought up that even on a relatively lower saturated fat diet in his ketogenic diet, he still saw that dramatic increase in LDL. So maybe I should start with there. From everything that you've read, does it seem that saturated fat intake does have a pretty significant correlation with blood levels of LDL?
Yeah, I would go even beyond correlation. I would say it's absolutely causative. And the reason why I can say that is because I've read before this whole like ketogenic craze and whatnot, the low carb and all that jazz, before I knew lean mass hyperresponders even existed, many years ago I read I think maybe 12 or 15 studies on low carb diets, and they did comparisons between higher saturated fat intake. So the same, everything else was the same. Calories were the same. The composition of the protein, carbohydrates, but the actual composition of the fats themselves were different. And a lot of what I looked at was looking at insulin resistance, but they did also usually report LDL levels or ApoB levels. And almost universally, I can't think of a single study where the saturated fat condition did not see an increase in LDL. Now, there's a caveat to that. If you are losing weight, that tends to mask this increase in LDL. So you actually see a drop in LDL, even though you may be consuming high amounts of saturated fat. However, if you're maintaining your weight, or if you're gaining, certainly if you're gaining weight, then you have an additive effect of the weight gain plus the additive saturated fat, compared to when people were consuming unsaturated fat using a low carb diet, they did not see this increase in LDL, if I remember correctly. So, and those were all randomized controlled trials. So they were specifically intervention trials, and they were showing not over massive amounts of time. So is it possible it might change later on? Admittedly, I don't think that it would change, but somebody could argue that it might. So, over 6 weeks, 3 weeks, maybe a few months, you tended to see this increase. It's not like you would see hundreds of points increase in LDL, though. It was something like, I don't know, maybe 50 or something like that, which is still sizable enough, but it's not like the lean mass hyperresponder effect.
So, and I have a
Yeah.
further point, but let me just pause for a
Sure.
second because you brought up something. You said that sometimes it is masked by weight loss, meaning that people who are losing weight, their LDL drops. That's kind of masked. Years back, came across some evidence to indicate that some people's LDL, and again, it's hard with my own blood work because, of course, there are natural fluctuations. So it's hard to say, hey, I did this and then this happened.
Sure.
But there was some indication that some people who lost weight, their LDL increased with the idea, I guess, being that more cholesterol was mobilized, something. I don't know the exact mechanism. But that's kind of the opposite of what you were saying, right? Okay. So is it just that some individuals see that randomly? You've come across that too?
So I've run across that actually specifically looking at fasting studies. But it also depends on the start point that they start at. So usually when people are overweight and they drop weight, their LDL decreases. At least that's based off of the studies that I've looked at. Although I'd be completely open and very interested to read other studies that show people who are overweight and lose weight and they see an increase in LDL. That would be really fascinating to me. The instances that I can think of where a person has maybe seen an increase in LDL when losing weight, keep in mind, this is in the context of specifically water fasting. So they're literally eating nothing. That was because they were generally about normal weight. So they weren't massively overweight, at least. And these are by metrics of BMI, which of course has its issues, but at least they weren't like obese. And they did see a slight increase in LDL, which ended up normalizing again after the fast. So I think that there is something to be said for maybe you might see a transient increase in LDL from weight loss for certain individuals. But the specifics of exactly what is causing that, I don't know. But I'd be fascinated to read some of that literature.
I've done a couple of 72-hour fasts, and I've done blood work on just one of them. Actually, I'm trying to pull it up now. So I have one after a 60-hour fast where my LDL was 133. And again, I mean, it's so hard to make sense of this when you only have like your one data point. I'd have to go back and look at what it was before. I don't think there was a substantial change. 118 was the prior reading, but again, I mean, that's within the range of a natural fluctuation anyway. So it's obviously hard to say there. But in any case, so right now I am about 3 weeks in to an experiment of pretty dramatically lowering my saturated fat. Now, obvious confounder there is that I am also in a dieting phase. So I just started dieting and I'm probably going to lose about 20 pounds. The reason, I mean, one, I can only manipulate my life so much for these experiments, but the reason that I don't think it's a huge confounder in my case is that I've had blood work done so many times over the years, and I've had it when bulking up, I've had it when dieting down. I have not seen clear changes in my LDL. It is almost always in that, even like 110 to 130. It's a pretty narrow range. And so because of that, I still think that this should be something that gives me some valuable data. I would expect for me to consider it significant, I would want to see my LDL probably sub 100. And of all the experiments I've done over the years, I've never done this. I love cheese. I usually will eat not like fatty cuts of meat, but like, a 93.7 turkey or ground beef or something like that. So my average saturated fat intake before was probably, not probably, it was between 30 and 60 grams per day, depending on the calorie intake of that day. Lately, ever since doing this experiment, it's been about 10 to 15 grams of saturated fat per day. So a pretty substantial decrease. It sounds like from everything both of us have read, I would expect to see a notable drop in LDL. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, generally, you'd have to do the math on that for the percentages because my understanding is that saturated fat is on an S curve, so it's sigmoidal. So if you consume a little bit of saturated fat, I think it's within the guidelines of like under 7% or under 10%. You typically anywhere in that range of 0 to 10% of your saturated fat usually don't see much of an effect on your LDL, and then suddenly. Or maybe is it LDL is the outcome or cardiovascular disease? I don't know. It's one of those two. And then if you start to get above that 10% mark, then you start to see this sudden increase. And let's just go with LDL. You start to see this sudden increase in LDL. And then you get to the top end where, let's say, you're consuming like 40% of your fat from saturated fat. Suddenly, you actually don't see much of an additional increase in LDL. So I think it would just depend on the percentage of where you started to the percentage of where you end up. But it seems to me like you've made a pretty dramatic drop from, you said, like 40 grams, something like that, down
Around
to
there.
about 10, 15 grams. So
Yeah.
I am curious though, what are you switching that out for? Because there are differences in the effect that it has on LDL depending on which nutrient that you substitute it with.
Right. Yeah, so that's a great question. And just real quick, were those percentages you just listed, was that percentage of saturated fat compared to total calories or compared to fat intake?
It's usually total calories, if I remember correctly.
Okay. So I'd have to do the math on that one, which is interesting because when it comes down to like protein intake, somebody like a Don Lehman would be very assertive in saying that, hey, we are looking at grams. People get into all these percentages, but your body recognizes grams of protein, and that's where our recommendations comes from. Whereas with this, I don't know if that's just an outdated model or and just what they happen to use, but it sounds like they're talking more in percentages of saturated fat here, which is interesting.
Yeah, it would be great to have that switch to be kind of like a to be grams per pound or grams per kilogram. I think that would
Right.
be a lot more useful than looking at percentages, although it's
Yeah.
not too difficult to calculate the percentages.
Right. And then, of course, there are instances where percentage does matter. Like, for example, again, going back to like a ketogenic diet, there's a relevance to how much of your diet is coming from what percentage is coming from different macronutrients. Because, again, I've heard a number of people talk about higher protein intakes and whatnot can affect that. So, but to go to your question, so in an ideal world, I would have just dropped again some of the cheeses and the meats and whatnot and replaced it with, let's say, like avocado oil and leaner meats. That is mostly what I have done. Again, it's confounded by the fact that my calories were averaging, maybe 3,300 calories before, and now they're averaging about 2,500 calories. I mean, that's a substantial drop. So part of it has just been lower total fat intake. And then, but again, higher levels of olive oil and avocado oil is mostly what it's been replaced with.
Okay, yeah. I mean that's the perfect way to do it. At least switching out from monounsaturated. The definitely polyunsaturated have the greatest effect on insulin resistance and on LDL levels, but monounsaturated fat is definitely the second best by comparison to like carbohydrates, which tend to have either a neutral effect or a very tiny effect size.
So just to clarify, you were saying that higher polyunsaturated fat intake would result in more improvement in LDL?
Yeah, if you were to switch out polyunsaturated fat instead of saturated fat, that would have the greatest effect.
And is that, I mean, obviously polyunsaturated fat, there's numerous types, and so are they looking at that specifically, like any, or are they just saying, hey, poly, is it like omega-6s, omega-3s?
It tends to be, so I think the focus usually is on N3, so usually on the omega-3, so like getting like it from fish or fish oil or
Sure.
krill oil or things like that. Of course, you probably can't just inundate yourself constantly with omega-3s. It's probably going to have to be a mixture of mono and saturated fat as
Yeah.
well, which is fine.
So I believe this is one of the speculations of the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, right? So for people who don't know, and you would be more familiar than I would be, but my understanding is they basically did this study where they said, hey, we're keeping fat total content the same between the two groups, but one is going to be higher saturated fat, one is going to be higher polyunsaturated fat. And despite the fact that the polyunsaturated fat group did have lower LDL, they had, I think, actually slightly higher risk, right? Heart disease risk. Was the outcome?
Yeah, it was death actually. So they
Definitely.
had more people that died in the polyunsaturated fat group compared to the saturated fat group. And then that, of course, people then use that and then run with it. And that's, I mean, it's understandable. You have lower LDL, okay. So you would expect that at least cardiovascular death would be reduced. And it wasn't. It was actually worse.
Yeah.
So the But what often gets left out of nutrition documentaries that reference this particular study, and what always gets left out, which is I always chuckle because anyway, I won't go into it, but what gets left out is that this analysis of the Minnesota Coronary Experiment was done, I suppose it released maybe 15 years ago. The Minnesota Coronary Experiment happened 30 or 40, 50 years before that. So it's been maybe 50, 60, 70 years since the actual experiment was done. And there's no problem. I don't have any problems whatsoever with like old data or anything like that. It should also be considered and also included. But the reason why, or at least the reason that was portrayed by the researchers, which is Ancel Keys and, France, I think. It's something with an F, but I'm forgetting the lead author. So the reason why they didn't publish the data for the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, again, by their words, you can believe it or not believe it, is because they had multiple massive issues with the study. And I'll explain what those are in just a little bit. And that's why they decided to only publish certain pieces of data that were not as affected by these massive issues that I'll go over. So then there's this, they essentially just stored the data and didn't touch it. So it just stayed locked away for 40 years or whatever until a researcher named Ramsden, if I remember the name correctly, I think that's correct, then was able to track down that data along with contacting the relatives of the deceased researchers that actually did the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, and were able to get some of the files from them as well and pull together the data that they had available, and then did the analysis for the full Minnesota Coronary Experiment. And then they found exactly what you said, so that the saturated fat condition did better than the polyunsaturated fat condition. And then what a lot of nutrition documentaries, typically low carb nutrition documentaries did, and a lot of people in the low carb community, they said, well, there you go, a randomized control trial that lasted for multiple years, I think 3 or 5 years, something, which is a very long time to do a randomized control trial. Maybe it was 2 years, but regardless, it was a long time. And they show saturated fat had this tremendous effect, this benefit. Okay, so but what's left out of that is that there was a rebuttal paper to that Ramsden paper. Nobody ever discusses that paper. And the reason why there's a rebuttal paper is because they list out all the major flaws with the Minnesota Coronary Experiment. And it turns out just as one major flaw, if which I think changes a lot of people's opinions on this study, is that the Minnesota Coronary Experiment was done on people that were institutionalized or hospitalized, in that they were kind of stuck in they were put into an institution, which now would be illegal. We couldn't, do experiments on people that have been institutionalized, for good reason. Obviously, they can't consent and whatnot. But it was done because it's a very controlled environment. So we can do these, we can, give this group of people this kind of diet and this group of people this other type of diet. And we know that the only thing they're consuming is exactly those diets for years. I mean, that's an amazing design, although unethical, as it was designed nowadays. The problem is that while the idea was a great idea in terms of the actual design, again, not talking about the ethics, it was the major problem with it is that while you would expect people to stay in this institution for long periods of time, therefore you could track them over long periods of time, there was a dropout rate of over 80% from the study. So the turnover from this, let me just to put this in perspective, for most studies, there's a dropout rate of maybe like 5%. To lose 80% of your participants, no journal nowadays they would laugh at you. The editor wouldn't even bring it to the reviewers because they would say that you're out of your mind if you want to actually publish this. And that's at least one of the reasons why the researchers decided not to publish this research. And they ended up publishing a much smaller subset, which was related to LDL because it was easier to track and they had enough data for it. Again, by their what they said. And then there were some other issues like trans fats were not really known back then. And that was also involved in the study. So there were higher levels of trans fats for one group over the other. I forget, there were two or three other major. Another thing, the study ended up determining that smoking was healthy. So I think that most people would say that smoking is not healthy nowadays. So would you trust a study that says smoking is healthy? And I mean, I'm not,
Didn't it
I
also
want to be.
show obesity was healthy, right, by those same standards?
Exactly. Yeah, there were multiple things that ended up showing that were actually healthier than not. Like obesity was healthier at being normal weight, smoking was healthier than not smoking, things like that. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't publish that kind of contradictory research, but it should be published in the eye of a well-performed study. If that's what the study results actually show, then we should publish that. But if the study has these massive gouging flaws in it, you're just publishing essentially just junk data, and like I said, at least no respected journal, I should say, because there's a lot of very low tier journals that actually solicit researchers to publish in their journals. But any well-established journal will say, absolutely not, we're not touching that, and for good reason. So it, once you start to learn those details, it really changes your perspective on like, should we really be relying our nutrition information on a study that was, it's not just confounding variables. I mean, these are huge holes. Like, take a cannon and just blast it through this study because it's just got so many issues.
The trans fat aspect, I don't want to just gloss over because I'm pretty sure that was a significant, people theorize that that's a significant reason why there was higher mortality in the higher polyunsaturated group. Trans fats really, I mean, if I remember back in, I think it was like 2014 or something, I remember seeing that they were going to be banned. And then being frustrated that every time I went to the grocery store, I was still seeing things with partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. So I don't know how long they took to actually do that, but it seemed to take quite a while. So my understanding there is that, trans fats really are shown to be the most harmful fat in terms of cardiovascular risk and mortality. And so hence why they've more or less been outlawed. So was it that the study just wasn't, I mean, they weren't aware of them at the time, but the foods included in the polyunsaturated group had more of the foods that we know have higher trans fats? Is that what it was basically coming down to?
I think so. I think, yeah, definitely don't quote me on this part because I'm not entirely certain. I remember doing a video on it and I read the paper, but I don't know if the original researchers were aware of trans fats, or maybe they did, but they tried to control for it, but they ended up making a mistake. I don't know, it was something along those lines. But either way, it got screwed up where there were substantial trans fats involved as well.
And I don't know if this is a topic you dove into at all, but my understanding was that the big issue, kind of coming back to the sodium, it's like, well, problem with sodium is it causes high blood pressure. So if you don't have high blood pressure, not as much a concern. My understanding was the mechanism by which trans fats increase risk is that it worsens your lipid profile. So basically, I don't know if it lowers HDL, but increases LDL. Do you know if that is the mechanism purported for why trans fats are negative?
So I've turned away from looking at trans fats mainly because it was banned, and then I thought like, well, nobody's going to care about this anymore pr pretty soon. But my understanding is that trans fats actually have a whole host of different negative effects. So they don't just affect LDL levels. And clearly, I mean, clearly the LDL levels drop. So the trans fats wouldn't have had that much of an effect on. I mean, maybe they increased LDL, but it wasn't. Or I guess it was slightly there was a drop in the polyunsaturated fat group, but maybe it would have dropped further. But I mean that's not really much of a point. But trans fats definitely have effects outside of just the lipid profile effect. So the exact specifics on that, it's been years since I've looked at that research
Okay.
because
Now
of, like I
that would
said, it
make
was.
sense to me because I was thinking exactly that. Like, well, hey, if the purported mechanism is that they increased LDL, well, in this study, the LDL was lower in that group anyway, so it's kind of a moot point.
Yeah,
But
makes sense.
yeah, if you're saying there are other potential mechanisms, then that would make sense. So, cool, man.
All right, guys, so that is it for part one this week. Part two will be live next week where we finish up with a few different topics. Hope you guys really enjoy this one, and we will see you next week.